lo que lees. Y listo, ya tienes Let's Cook por solo $16.95 en baogantienda.com y te lo mandamos a casa gratis. Entra en baogantienda.com. Consíguelo antes de que se enfríe.
Gentlemen, and welcome to Western Civilization, from Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host, my name is Guy Williams, and on this program, I'm going to be speaking about General George Armstrong Custer. Yeah, he was going to be president. He wanted to be president. An extremely vain man, with a very large ego. But of course, in that, he was not alone. Many of the 19th century politicians were just that way. And many 20th and 21st century politicians have a very, very large ego. Perhaps that is a requisite for the job. In any case, Custer, in particular, was destined for the presidency because he had been a war hero. Now, my regular listeners will remember that I have spoken about the great Civil War battle, perhaps the most famous Civil War battle, the Battle of Gettysburg. I've spoken about it before. I will speak about it in greater detail in an upcoming program. But if Gettysburg has a hero, then that hero is George Armstrong Custer. At one point during the battle, you remember that this is the battle that the South really needed to win, that the commanding general of the South, Robert E. Lee, he needed something dramatic, something aggressive going up north because, well, there was another battle taking place almost simultaneously down south, the Battle of Vicksburg, that was going to give the Union access to the entire Mississippi River and cut off those parts of the Confederacy that, well, at the time it was called Trans-Mississippi, on the other side of the Mississippi, including Texas. All of that, the areas where the South was getting quite a lot of supply and provision because of contrabando, right? Because of smuggling there. There was a Union blockade, but the blockade was not as effective in the Gulf of Mexico as it was along the Atlantic. And so you could get things in through Texas that would eventually find their way into the heart of the Confederacy. But, well, with the Battle of Vicksburg, the only real road in the South, the Mississippi River, that was gone. The Confederacy could no longer use it. The Union was now established along the South, broken into the Union, established along. Well, it was going to be necessary to relieve Vicksburg and make those Union forces run back to try and defend Washington D.C. or something like that. Well, what they did was they went along the Shenandoah Valley right into the heart of Pennsylvania, and there were very few people expected. Certainly not the people from Pennsylvania. There, the Confederacy attacked and the Union had to make its stand. Now, fortunately for the Union, they were there first. Fortunately, they had an idea of what the battle was going to look like, and so they put themselves up on an area, una especie de mini cresta, no? A place called Cemetery Ridge. It was going to be necessary for the Confederate cavalry under the great Confederate Civil War hero, Jeb Stuart. Leading that Confederate cavalry, which was expert, which was at the top of its game, even though the South didn't have access to the best horses at this point, even though the South didn't have access to the best artillery or weapons, guns, still, the cavalry was formidable. Now, Jeb Stuart, leading the bulk of the Confederate cavalry behind Union lines at Gettysburg, attacking from the behind, and General Custer, well, there was part of the Union Army had broken ranks, and everything was vulnerable. Everything was vulnerable. A good Confederate attack at this time could have ruined the Union plans, could have destroyed General Meade's plans, and that, of course, would put the Confederacy in the heart of Pennsylvania, that would make Washington perhaps more vulnerable, although many of the people at the time, they were calling Washington the Gibraltar of the West because it was so well defended. But still, the idea of being able to cut off and isolate Washington, D.C., that was always part of the Confederate strategy. But yes, it was all done for one reason: to show the world it could be done, to create panic in the Union and occupy soldiers and perhaps relieve, you know, make General Grant come north from Vicksburg, but at the same time send a signal to the world that this could be done. Now, Stuart's Confederate cavalry behind Union lines, Stuart attacking, and General Custer defending against 10 times as many troops. Custer as a military genius. Custer as courageous. Custer at his finest. And so, yeah, he was undisputed as the great war hero. And of course, after the war, everybody had enormous egos talking about what they had done, what they had seen. And Ulysses S. Grant had become president. Why not Custer? Custer was very photogenic, very good looking, and he knew it. He was extraordinarily vain. He had yellow hair, and he kept his yellow hair in perfect condition. Now, and by the way, I'll be talking about this on a subsequent program, but the fact is that Custer, well, the South in general, after the war, they definitely won the propaganda battle, so that their a determination to commemorate and build monuments. Remember, when you wherever there's a monument, you really don't have to think critically about history. All you have to do is venerate, right? Memorializing history by building a statue or something like that, that immediately silences critical voices. You know, somebody saying, well, the generals in this war, they were kind of inept. Have you no respect? This is sacred ground. This is the way history is treated all over the place. Monumentalizing is a technique for keeping silent about something. In any case, the South won the propaganda value, battle rather after the, and they were able to create a very romantic idea that of course was put into all of our minds with the film Gone with the Wind, Lo que el viento se llevó, right? That was a massive best-selling book. And then the greatest Hollywood movie of all time. And if you ask people about the Civil War today, most people will recite what they saw in the film Gone with the Wind. That is how powerful a piece of propaganda it was. But yes, this is the way it worked. Now, Custer, who knows? Custer might have been able to change all that. Undisputed military hero. He, after the war, wanted further glory. And so, right after the American Civil War, you start with the Indian Wars. There is a gold rush to South Dakota, and the indigenous peoples living there resist. Some of them, like the Cherokee, had been taken out away from their homes on the East Coast and forcibly marched to the Plains states, where they had to adopt a completely different lifestyle and make their peace with other Indians in the area. Well, in any case, Custer was in charge of the 7th Cavalry in the Dakotas. The Indians there, many of them living a nomadic or semi-nomadic lifestyle on the plains with the buffalo, much of that made perfect sense. Now, many of their tactics were the tactics used by nomadic peoples, which do not involve a stationary battle. It involves motion. It involves running, hitting, withdrawing. All of these things by tribes that on horseback, warriors on horseback, where mobility is the key. Right? Infantry is vulnerable in this. It all has to be cavalry. Now, after months of trying to bring the tribes in the Dakota territories into battle, into a real battle, and drawing the conclusion that they were cowards, that they would run away. Well, the plan was for the army to invade from three directions and converge on the hostiles, to pressure the hostiles together, where they to trap the hostiles with these three armies, and there to eliminate them, to exterminate them. Now, the 7th Cavalry was going to be one of these columns, and Lieutenant Colonel Custer, believe it or not, he was one of the youngest generals ever, and he had accepted this demotion to Lieutenant Colonel just so he could be there. So, that was the plan. But, I think it was Mike Tyson. Mike Tyson said, everybody has a plan until they hit you in the face. And that's very true. No, I'm sorry. He said, everybody has a strategy. Everybody has a strategy until they hit you in the face. And so this strategy fell apart. In the north, the force was driven back, right? In the north, there was a confrontation, and they could not proceed. They had to withdraw. So that the other two columns were going to be responsible for this convergence, for this sort of simultaneous invasion. Now, the fact is that these columns were isolated from each other, out of touch with each other. They really didn't know. There was no telegraph, no way to signal. So that Custer, obviously, didn't understand that the northern column had failed in its task. He did not know that he didn't have the support he was counting on. Now, he believed that speed was essential so that his cavalry was going to have to ride as fast as it could. First, that involved leaving the wagons behind, leaving everything that is the provisions, the supplies, all of the logistical backup, everything in wagons, everything carried by horses or freight. Now, part of that were the weapons he was carrying, automatic weapons, the ametralladoras, right, or prototipos de ametralladoras, the Gatling guns that were going to be so effective in the First World War, 20, 25 years later. The prototype of the Gatling gun was there for the Indian Wars. And that alone could have made a difference when Custer was finally surrounded. The fact is that this was a new technology, and they say that every war fought, you know, every time that you fight a war, it's always the last war. So that the Korean War was fought with the mentality of the Second World War, and the Vietnam War was fought with the mentality of the Korean War, and the war in Iraq was fought with the mentality of the Vietnam War. The things like this. You're always fighting the last war. Now, these machine guns had been practically insignificant during the American Civil War. And so the generals tended to ignore them and distrust them. The second decision made by General Custer was to believe what he wanted to believe. They told him that there were many, many, many hostiles up ahead. And he didn't want to hear that, so he simply ignored it. I was speaking a minute ago about the war in Korea, the time that North Korea invaded South Korea, and it was General MacArthur who organized the Marine landing at Incheon, something very, very risky. Everybody calls it brilliant now because it worked. but there was every indication at the time that it was not going to work. And if it hadn't worked, nobody would be calling it brilliant in any case. One thing that MacArthur didn't do was pay attention to what the people on the ground, the people who actually knew, the people doing the fighting, to what they were telling him, right? Just like General Custer, these people were coming and saying, we have Chinese prisoners. There are Chinese fighting with the Koreans. And MacArthur didn't want to hear that, so he didn't believe them. Now, the fact is that he didn't really think highly of either the Sioux, or we don't say Sweeks, it's the Sioux, it's a like French, right? Everything in that area first discovered by the French, and so given the French pronunciation, Michigan, Chicago, the Sioux, all right, the Sioux and the Cheyenne. And by breaking up his own command into three distinct parts in order to ensure that nobody could escape, he was being very, very unorthodox, if not to say kind of stupid. The fact is that the camp he was approaching contained more than 5,000 families, women and children, that it would be very, very difficult for these people simply to get on their horses and ride away. No, they were prepared to defend the ground. They were not going to disappear. This was not that kind of war. A man named Benteen, Captain Benteen, was in charge of one of the three columns. The other two columns under Major Reno and Custer himself. The village was going to be hit simultaneously from north and south. Major Reno's column, however, was confronted by hundreds of warriors, and it was necessary for him to pull back. They drove Reno back across a river and up on top of high ground, un otero, right? Otero, a bluff. That's what we call it. Now, Custer and 210 of his men were attacking the village. That meant that Reno and Benteen were able to come together. But Custer, in order to do this, isolated himself. He was all alone at that point. Okay, I'm going to have to take a short break now, but I'll be back in just a couple of minutes with the second part of the program.
To Vaughn Radio.
Ay, ¿te imaginas? Ahí tumbado en la playa, en la piscina, vagueando sin nada que hacer, con su cañita, las tapitas. Y claro, luego vendrá septiembre y empezaremos ahí. Ay, ¿por qué no aproveché el verano para darle un empujoncito a mi inglés? Pero claro, estás ahí, Manolo, tumbado todo el día en la piscina, vagueando. Pero, como siempre, los de Vaughan tenemos la solución. Pues para eso traemos a María y a Richard. ¿Qué tal? ¿Qué tal estáis?
Fine, yeah. I want to hear what the solution is, María.
Pues mira, tenemos los cursos intensivos de verano.
Eso es.
¿En qué consisten esos cursos?
Pues son cursos muy buenos que ayudan a refrescar y a consolidar el nivel de inglés, que es muy importante, sobre todo para gente que no tiene tiempo, que se queda ahí todo el año, que está muy agobiada.
O Manolo, que está
ahí vagueando. O Manolo, que está en la piscina tranquilamente. Pues Manolo viene, se viene por la mañana 4 horas, cada día de lunes a viernes, y cuando llegue septiembre está con el inglés en plena forma.
Manolo o Dani, no vaya que los Manolos se me enfaden.
O Juan.
Rápido los teléfonos, 91-133-5833.
That y was fast, can you say that again?
91-133-5833.
Okay.
Y Barcelona, 93-339-8687. Y que también tenemos los cursos en Bilbao, Valencia, Santander, Vigo, Valladolid, Zaragoza y, bueno, Madrid, las tablas. Y tenemos más opciones para los jóvenes.
El Vaughan Town para jóvenes y el VIP for Teens. Tenemos las dos opciones, que están muy
Vamos
bien.
A empezar por el VIP.
VIP es para niños que ya tienen 16 años, para que den clases de inglés las primeras semanas de julio, las 3 primeras, que está muy bien porque van a reforzar bastante. Y el Vaughan Town para jóvenes a partir de 18 hasta 21, que también les viene muy bien para tener esa inmersión lingüística que sus papás seguramente están deseando que hagan.
And the Vaughan Town for young people, yeah, mm-hmm. for 18-year-olds. Where is it?
It's in Alcázar de San Juan.
Okay, cool. So not far from Madrid.
No, no está nada lejos.
Or if you live in Seville, it's pretty, on the train, it's pretty close
Eso
too.
Es.
So mm-hmm. ideal.
Y este año tenemos una novedad.
Que ellos, los jóvenes, van a compartir habitación con los anglos, es decir, las chicas con las chicas, los chicos con los chicos, okay. y van a poder seguir manteniendo conversaciones hasta...
All night long!
Eso es.
Una inmersión.
All night long, that's Vamos. Absolutely total immersion, isn't it?
24 horas de inglés, okay. como esta radio.
Uh-huh. Eso es.
Teléfonos, nuevamente, ya deberían sabérselo, 911-335-833 para adultos y para los junior, 32. Ya sabéis, pero toda la información la podéis encontrar en grupovaughan.com.
Exactly, and if you phone that number, you can speak to Maria, because you
claro.
will answer sometimes.
Sí, claro.
You're listening to Vaughn Radio.
El pueblo angloparlante de Vaughan gana decisión y seguridad en 6 días de inmersión en inglés. Disfruta de un entorno privilegiado y mejora, por fin, tu agilidad oral y comprensión auditiva. Piensa, habla, vive en inglés. Llámanos al 91-133-5833.
Esto lo que oyes.
You're listening to the right radio. You're listening to Vaughan Radio. You're listening to Vaughan Radio.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Western Civilization. From Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host, my name is Guy Williams, and on this program, on the first part of the program, I was speaking about Custer's last stand. I was speaking about General George Armstrong Custer, how he had distinguished himself at the Battle of Gettysburg, how he was an authentic Civil War hero, and was considering the idea of running for president. Now, he probably would have become president. He was, as I say, very muy pagado de sí, right? They're full of himself, as most of the Civil War generals were at that point, whether on the winning side or on the losing side. Many of them were living from their reenactment of these glorious battles of the Civil War. In any case, Custer himself, extraordinarily vain about his appearance, but again, rewarded for his appearance and might have been extremely photogenic and would have become easily presidential candidate. Now, he made a series of mistakes, tactical mistakes, which I have already mentioned. This was due to the fact that the Indians living on the plains, las llanuras, with the buffalo, had, logically, established a semi-nomadic lifestyle, so that they were capable of going long distances following the buffalo, and practically all the warriors were on horseback. They were riding like cavalry. And like warriors, Mongols or Turkic peoples in the las estepas, no? Asiáticas, on the steppes of Asia, like the Huns, the Alans, geographic conditions. It just makes sense when you're on horseback to be exceptionally mobile, to attack and retreat and attack and move. Whereas General Custer was much more accustomed to fighting a fixed battle along lines, enemy versus enemy. And the fact is that the style of fighting caused him to significantly underestimate what the Cheyenne and Sioux tribes were capable of. So, yeah, in the end, as I say, he made several mistakes. Dividing his forces into three, believing that the Indians, when confronted, would try to simply disappear. He divided his forces into three columns that were not in contact with each other, and so not coordinated. And when it was time to converge, they simply did not. Two of the three columns came together, but Custer was isolated. Custer and his men began to attack the village, astonished at the number of teepees, right, of the structures that they found there. And, well, they decided to retreat, but retreat into country that they had never seen before. So they didn't have any of the home advantages, right? This was a hilly land, rolling hills, and just the worst place to fight, the worst place to make a last stand. He led his 210 men down into the camp, seeing that there were perhaps over 1,000 teepees there. He diverted the attack and confronted more than 1,000 warriors who had come hearing the news that their families were vulnerable, that where their families were under attack. Now, as I mentioned on the first part of the program, if he had only kept some of his high technology weapons, that might have given him an advantage. Artillery or the Gatling guns, right? These metralladoras, or the prototypes of machine guns. But he had left them behind. And yes, they fought to the last man and died. This was perhaps the most dramatic defeat in American history, certainly on American territory. Now, for the Native Americans, it represented a public relations disaster. Naturally, people back home reading the newspaper, thinking about the outrage of all of this, they came to the conclusion that the Native Americans were hostile and could not be treated as civilized, could not be given the benefit of reservation land or dealt with in a reasonable way, so that there was going to be a tide, right? Una marea de, a tide of public opinion against negotiation. In addition to which, there was a certain amount of rivalry among the Indian tribes. And the most prominent leader among the Indian tribes, a man named Caballo Loco, no? Crazy Horse, the Oglala Sioux chief, who spoke for many of the people there, who looked for the consensus. He had enemies. One of those enemies told the commander of the U.S. cavalry in that area that Crazy Horse was trying to negotiate only as a cover, as a pretext for murder. That this man, General Crook, was going to be killed during a talk, during the cowboy word that they use is parley. We got that, of course, from French, parler. But yes, the word for negotiating with Indians, a parley. So yeah, Crook wanted Crazy Horse in jail. In early September, Crazy Horse had refused to engage in attacks on the Europeans, on the Americans in this case. There was a group of warriors led by Chief Red Cloud, who was not, he didn't want to stay on the reservation. He wanted to attack, and Crazy Horse convinced many of the others to stay on that reservation. So yes, he was already, as a peacemaker, he was already under suspicion by the hotheads, by the people who wanted a more aggressive response to what was happening. So, the local colonel asked Crazy Horse to come to a parley. Crazy Horse agreed, innocently. But the idea was that this was going to be a preemptive attack. Now, this area, this fort, a place called Cap Robinson, there were already thousands of the Lakota people there when Crazy Horse arrived. Many of them were there because he had told them to come. Now, he entered the camp, and he wanted to begin negotiations in good faith. But the local commander, a man named Bradley, decided that now that he had Crazy Horse in front of him, then the man was much too powerful to be kept free. That he would have to be put in jail. Bradley ordered his arrest. The arrest, of course, would involve, at best, exile, maybe to Florida, maybe to the Los Cayos, no? Los Cayos de Florida, the Florida Keys, someplace like that, someplace remote, where he could not be, he could no longer influence his people. At best. At worst, the arrest would be a death sentence. Now, Crazy Horse, again, innocent Crazy Horse, allowed himself to be led toward the jail until he realized what was actually happening. And then he ran outside. He had only a knife with him. And finding himself surrounded by soldiers, he began to put up a fight. He didn't last long. He was stabbed, apuñalado, with a bayonet, and he died that evening. With him died any hope of peaceful resolution. There was an enormous massacre shortly afterwards of the Lakota people. And with the death of Crazy Horse, all of that was pretty much guaranteed. Again, a victory that ends in defeat, a Pyrrhic victory. Now, the fact is that afterwards, well, there were still moments of resistance. Toward the end of the 19th century, a new religious cult began, and it spread from tribe to tribe, from reservation to reservation. It involved a dance, a certain kind of dance, certain kind of music, certain kind of ritual, a calling back the dead and the way of life previous to the arrival of the Europeans, the way of life which had also died. At this time, there were practically no buffalo left. People actually believed that the buffalo, which had numbered in the millions, that the buffalo were now extinct. In any case, this sort of dancing, this sort of ritual, this sort of new religious cult was supposed to give these warriors invincibility, so that if they were wearing the proper costume, which was white, it was deer skin, but it had been painted or stained white, and it had a special series of drawings on it, like talismans, and anyone wearing it was supposed to be impervious to bullets. And naturally they were not. But because it had this religious fervor, many of the people still believed it, even though they saw their comrades falling around them. When they resisted, the army opened fire. People began to die like flies, and still, many of the true believers thought that this was temporary. In any case, this was the last stand, the final resistance. By the end of the 19th century, there was really nothing left. There were, of course, few cases like the Apache, able to play both sides because of their, the fact that they could easily cross the border from Mexico into the United States and back. There were, yes, certain token resistance after that, but still, almost immediately, you had the dramatization and romanticization of this. It became a source of, endless source of literature. And almost immediately, tourism. And so you had different productions, performances. Buffalo Bill's Indian Show, starring Sitting Bull. Sitting Bull became part of the Indian show, reenacting his own defeat in every performance. And because this is the end of the 19th century, only a little later, at the beginning of the 20th, you find cinema. And because Edison is trying to monopolize the industry on the East Coast, you have many people coming out to the West, to Southern California, to what is going to be Hollywood, trying to escape from this monopoly, from all of the extra things that that were going on there, and almost like piratas, no, pirates. The industry of Hollywood began as a pirate industry, trying to get away from all of the patents and copyrights and so forth that Edison was using against anyone who wasn't Edison in this new industry. In addition to which, he was, well, he had a completely different idea of how movies should be created and watched. So, with the cinema in the West, it was absolutely natural that themes from the Wild West would be the very first thing in cinema. So yeah, Hollywood began with a large component, a major component of the West. And so many of the first dramas, Tom Mix and others, it became vastly popular. One of the great hits, The Great Train Robbery, one of the first great mega hits to come out of Hollywood with Western themes. So, in just a couple of decades, the whole the result of the Indian Wars had completely metamorphosed into a fantasy of what the Wild West had been. And of course, the indigenous people still languishing on reservations in land that really had no no intrinsic value to anyone, much less to the people who were forced to live there. And at the same time, again, a fantasy that absorbed the imagination of the entire world. Cowboys and Indians. Meanwhile, and speaking of the indigenous peoples, I'd like to talk a little bit about Hawaii, which up until this time had been more or less independent, but by the end of the 19th century, that independence was considered a luxury, which was simply going to end. Now, when we talk about Hawaii, we have to go back in time. We have to, one of the first, presumably the first people to see Hawaii, Spanish, naturally, as part of the Manila galleons. Those galleons, starting at a very early time from Acapulco in New Spain, which is what the viceroyalty was called, New Spain, what is today Mexico, from Acapulco going to Manila. Again, discovered, explored, Legazpi and so forth, the colony there, doing business with China. That was exceptionally lucrative, and there was extensive exploration of the Pacific. And in one of the log books, bitácoras, there are Spanish explorers that talk about a volcanic eruption in islands in the middle of the Pacific. And this, presumably, is the first reference to Hawaii that we have. But of course, it's going to be much later that the British arrived there, the second half of the 18th century, and Captain Cook, James Cook, names these islands after his great patron, the Earl of Sandwich. At this point, they become the Sandwich Islands. But again, the indigenous people are still living there. The indigenous people are going to, in fact, revolt and kill Captain Cook, who never was able to continue, was able to finish his journey, his voyage. All right, I seem to have run out of time. Thank you for listening, and please, on my next program, I will speak extensively about Hawaii.
En Vaughan siempre hemos hablado que un pilar fundamental son los profesores. Todos tienen que pasar un proceso riguroso de selección seguido de un duro periodo de formación en el que aprenden a utilizar el método Vaughan de enseñanza. Los que son seleccionados tras finalizar la formación reúnen las cualidades óptimas personales para triunfar como profesores de idiomas, sobre todo para personal de empresa. Estas cualidades son responsabilidad, carácter, dominio técnico y, lo más importante de todo, la capacidad para ganarse el respeto y aprecio de personas de todos los rangos corporativos, desde operarios hasta presidentes de empresa. Marta Martínez, coordinadora de Teacher Training y Reclutamiento, nos cuenta cómo es la formación de profesores.
Nos dedicamos principalmente a hacer dos cosas. La primera es...